Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo, Kelly Jean Kelly, Brian Lynn, Ashley Thompson, and Katie Weaver. But first, this report. In many ways, the time spent seeking an education at a college or university can be some of the best years of a person's life. College students are usually just entering adulthood. Their academic programs present them with all kinds of new information and ideas. And even given the many demands on their time from their studies, the students often have the freedom to explore their identities and other outside interests. But a person's college years can also present difficulties. Sometimes the challenges of academic success, making new friends, and living far from home may feel like more than one person can deal with alone. In fact, more and more college students in the United States have reported suffering from anxiety and depression, says Monica Osborne. She heads the Counseling Center and Prevention Services at North Carolina State University in Raleigh, North Carolina. Osborne says it is important for students to have access to mental health services on campus. Off-campus options are likely too costly and difficult to get to for many students. Research shows that having access to mental health services can help prevent students from dropping out of college, Osborne adds. Such services can make students feel more like their school really cares about them. Osborne believes it is a good sign that more students are seeking mental health services. That means more of them are trying to find solutions to difficulties or problems they are facing. Half the battle, sometimes, is walking through the door, because there can be a lot of stigma with asking for help or receiving mental health counseling, especially if you are an international student who may not have counseling services at home, Osborne told VOA. So being able to come in, ask questions, see what the office looks like, will go a long way in breaking down some of those barriers. College students may struggle with many kinds of unhealthy behaviors. For example, they often ignore their need for sleep because they want to spend time with their friends. Or they might stay up all night to study for a big test. One night of poor sleep may not be a major issue, Osborne says. But if it happens again and again, a student's mental health may suffer. The worst part, Osborne says, is that many students may not even recognize what they are experiencing as a mental health problem. A lot of students don't think about mental health and the outcomes there, said Osborne. Their symptoms might look more like physical symptoms, like being physically sick, when many of those could be symptoms of anxiety. Osborne urges any student who is facing problems or experiencing feelings they do not understand to visit their school's counseling center. These centers employ trained mental health experts who will discuss these issues privately with the student. Once a student meets with one of these experts, they can start to explore the things they are dealing with and what they might want from counseling. This can include general skills to deal with common problems or just talking through a given issue. From there, students can plan ongoing individual meetings with a mental health expert, or the expert can connect the student with groups of students having similar problems, says Osborne. Campus counseling can sometimes even help students find the support they need elsewhere. Not every student needs therapy, she said. But if a student comes in and we know they're struggling, it might be related to food insecurity or some sort of financial issue. Since we know the resources on campus so well, then we can connect that student with those resources, teach them how to work through those new systems, and then problem solve. I'm Pete Musto.
Now it's time for Words and Their Stories, a program from VOA Learning English. Each week, we tell the story of words and expressions often used in American English. Some of them are old, others are new. Together, they form a living language. On today's show, we will be talking about the act of hitting someone with the palm of your hand. We call this a slap. Growing up, you may have experienced a slap or two. Do you remember how it felt? Probably not good. And when the slap is on your face, the feeling is even worse. You often do not see it coming until the open palm lands on your cheek. The sting on your face can cause tears to well up in your eyes. It hurts. And you may feel insulted and offended. And that brings us to today's expression, a slap in the face. Used as an expression, a slap in the face is not a physical act. It is a surprising action or comment that offends someone. A slap in the face is humiliating and can also cause disappointment. Word experts say the expression dates back to the late 1800s. It may have come from the idea of defending yourself against unwanted sexual attention. When that happens, you might slap that person across the face. Generally speaking, in the 1800s, women would likely be the ones slapping men in those situations. But the expression, a slap in the face, could also come from an old tradition between men, the duel. A duel is a contest with deadly weapons arranged between two people in order to settle a point of honor. In the past, a man could challenge another to a duel by slapping him across the face with an empty glove. To protect his honor or to save face, the slapped person must agree to the duel. Today, the expression, a slap in the face, means an insult. More often than not, a slap on the face is done on purpose. It is intentional. Now, let's hear how to use a slap in the face in everyday life. Imagine actors preparing for a big show. Catherine is in the studio rehearsing her song. Then suddenly, Oscar bursts into the room. He is so angry he can barely speak. Catherine stops singing and stops the music.
Oscar, I'm right in the middle of my big song. What's the matter?
Sorry, Kat, but I just got some really bad news.
My name is Catherine, not Kat.
Can we please stop talking about you for a minute? The director is giving my part in the show to Manuel.
What? Why?
She said that Manuel is really talented and deserves to play the lead.
Whoa. What a slap in the face. Your face, I mean.
I know how that idiom works, Catherine. Thanks.
So what else did she say?
She said that lately I've been, very unprofessional.
She must be talking about all those rehearsals you've missed.
Perhaps.
But the show opens in a week. What are you going to tell your friends and family?
I have no idea. They've planned a big opening night party and everything. This is so humiliating. How can I face them?
Ooh, that's going to be a huge loss of face. Again, I'm talking about your face.
Can you stop with all these humiliation idioms? They're not helping.
Sorry, but wow, what a blow.
Cat.
What a blow indeed. And that's all we have for you on today's show. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
In late August 1619, an English ship named the White Lion stopped in what is now the American state of Virginia. It left behind more than 20 captive Angolans. They were the first known Africans to step onto Britain's American colonies. Their arrival 400 years ago began the history of slavery in English-speaking America. The practice of enslaving Africans continued for more than 200 years. From 1525 to 1866, close to 400,000 African men, women, and children arrived in what is now the United States. They were sold or traded to wealthy owners of large farms. They had to work the crops, the cornfields, the tobacco fields. It was a life they had to endure, knowing they would probably never be free, says Calvin Pearson. He leads a history group called Project 1619. At first, Africans had no official place in the American colonies. They were not called slaves, but they were different from indentured servants. Those were people who chose to come to the colonies and work in exchange for the cost of travel. After a given number of years, indentured servants were free to move on from such work. But captive Africans came against their will, and they did not expect freedom. In 1662, lawmakers in Virginia officially established slavery. They passed a law that said any child born to an enslaved black woman faced being enslaved forever, too. Under that system, the number of American slaves grew to almost 4 million.
Slave labor helped build the American colonies and later the new nation. Historian Cassandra Newby Alexander says slavery was so big and so important to the American economy that it was valued at more than all of America's other industries combined. Each American state could decide whether to permit slavery. In southern states, a large number of enslaved people cared for crops that required a lot of work, such as cotton. A smaller number of enslaved people lived in northern states. They mostly cared for white people's houses and families or did skilled labor. In time, many northern states slowly banned slavery. but Northerners still benefited from the system. For example, one early white lawmaker in the northeastern state of Rhode Island made a huge amount of money off the lives of enslaved Africans. The lawmaker, James DeWolfe, invested in slave ships as well as in banks and companies that did business with slaveholders. He also put money in factories that turned cotton into clothes, an operation that helped launch the country's industrial revolution. Even after Rhode Island outlawed the shipment of slaves to North America, James DeWolfe's relatives continued the slave trade illegally. One family member says the DeWolfes brought more than 12,000 enslaved Africans to North America. He adds that the family is probably responsible for about 500,000 people who are alive today in the Americas.
The system of slavery in the United States ended unofficially in 1863 during the country's civil war between southern and northern states. It ended officially in 1865. That year, the Constitution was changed to ban enslavement. But the system of slavery has had a lasting effect. Vladimiro Fortuna directs the National Museum of Slavery in Luanda, Angola. He said the hundreds of years of slave trade changed his country. Today, at least one-third of Angolans live in poverty, even though Angola has one of the best economies in sub-Saharan Africa. This country was harmed in every single aspect, says Fortuna. The social fabric was destroyed. Fortuna adds that slavery also deeply affected other African societies. It wasn't possible during the times of slavery and colonization for African societies to reorganize their political and labor systems. Sometimes people try to forget this part of the country's history.
In the United States, some lawmakers have proposed creating a group to examine and address the continued negative effects of slavery in the country. The measure notes that laws and policies, even after slavery ended, have discriminated against black people. Supporters of the bill suggested that the U.S. government should pay money to the descendants of slaves or formally apologize to them, or both. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell opposes the idea of paying reparations, however. I don't think reparations for something that happened 150 years ago, for whom none of us currently living are responsible, is a good idea, he said. But many people alive today do remember. Among them are descendants of James DeWolfe, the white lawmaker who made a fortune off the slave system. His relatives have made a film and created an organization to increase awareness of the slave trade and its lasting effects. Descendants of enslaved Africans also recall their ancestors' place in history. Brenda Tucker is a relative of likely the first child born to Africans in the American colonies. His name was William Tucker. His body is buried near the place where the white lion ship landed in 1619. As she visits William Tucker's burial place, Brenda Tucker notes that many of those who were forced onto slave ships from Angola did not survive. But the ones that did survive were the healthy ones, our ancestors. Tucker looks around the site and adds that she cannot pass through the area without thinking of an ancestor, someone who is owed our thanks. I'm Brian Lynn.
And I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
Today, we visit one of the most famous national parks in America. You can find it in the Sierra Nevada Mountains of the western state of California. It is one of the most stunning places in the country. Its name is Yosemite. Yosemite National Park is a place of extremes. It has high mountains. It has valleys formed by ancient ice that cut deep into the earth millions of years ago. Water from high in the mountains falls in many places to the Green Valley far below. There are 13 waterfalls in Yosemite Valley. One of these falls, Yosemite Falls, is the fifth highest on Earth. Up in the mountains are clear lakes, fast-moving rivers, and huge rock formations. One rock is called Half Dome. It rises more than 2,700 meters into the air.
More than 60 kinds of animals live in the park. Deer are very common. You might even see a large black bear. And more than 200 kinds of birds live in Yosemite. In a place called the Mariposa Grove, visitors can see some of the largest, tallest, and oldest living things on Earth. These are the giant sequoia trees. One of these trees is called Grizzly Giant. It is more than 1,800 years old. It is almost 63 meters tall. At its base, it is 28 meters around. The old sequoia trees can make visitors feel quite small. The story of the Sierra Nevada Mountains and the area that is Yosemite National Park begins about 500 million years ago, when the area was at the bottom of an ancient sea. Scientists believe strong earthquakes forced the bottom of the sea to rise above the water. After millions of years, it was pushed up into the air to form land and mountains. At the same time, hot liquid rock from deep in the earth pushed to the surface. This liquid rock slowly cooled. This cooling liquid formed a very hard rock, known as granite.
Years and years of rain caused huge rivers to move violently through the area. Over time, these rivers cut deep into the new mountains. During the Great Ice Age, millions of tons of ice cut and shaped the cooled granite to form giant rocks. Millions of years later, these would become the giant rocks like Half Dome and El Capitan in Yosemite National Park. Humans lived in the area of Yosemite for more than 4,000 years. The first people who lived there were hunters. Most were members of a tribe of Native Americans called the Miwok. A famous hunter and explorer named Joseph Walker passed through the area in the 1830s. He reported about the massive rock formations. In 1864, a United States senator called for legislation to give the Yosemite Valley to the state of California as a public park. The legislation said the valley should be preserved and protected. President Abraham Lincoln signed the bill. The event marked the first time that a government had approved a law to preserve and protect land because of its great beauty. The land was to be kept for the public to enjoy. Yosemite became the first state park. It was the first real park in the world. Then, in 1890, it became a national park. The National Park Service is responsible for the park today.
Yosemite is about 320 kilometers east of San Francisco. The small roads leading to the park pass over lower parts of the huge mountains. Then the road goes lower and lower into the Yosemite Valley. Visitors to Yosemite Park can stay in several kinds of places. Beautiful old hotels are near the park. Some are very costly. Many visitors bring tents to Yosemite and camp in the park. Visitors can walk through the beautiful valley and the mountains. There are more than 1,100 kilometers of walking paths. Some short trails take only a few minutes to walk. Others can take days to complete.
People come from all over the world to climb Yosemite's rock formations. The most famous of these is called El Capitan. Climbers call it El Cap. Climbing El Cap is only for rock climbing experts. It is difficult and dangerous. The climb is straight up the face of a rock wall. Most people take about 3 days to climb to the top of El Cap. Climbers must look for cracks in the rock. They place their hands and feet in the cracks and work their way up. They also use ropes and special equipment. From the bottom of the valley to the top of El Cap is about 1,100 meters. The climbers on El Cap must rest and sleep during the climb. They hang cloth beds or hammocks on the rocks. In 2015, two American rock climbers made history by becoming the first people to free climb El Cap's Dawn Wall. It is considered one of the hardest climbs in the world. Free climbing means climbing with little special equipment and ropes. It took them 19 days to climb all the way to the top.
In summer, Yosemite Park is filled with visitors. Large buses bring people from San Francisco to spend the day. Other visitors come by car. Some even come by bicycle. About 4 million people visit the park every year. In the winter, heavy snow falls in the Sierra Nevada Mountains and Yosemite. The snow usually begins in November. Heavy snow forces some of the roads into Yosemite to close during the winter months. The National Park Service works hard to keep most of the roads open.
I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.